Welcome to Shanghai Zan, a raw and lively regular debate about China tech, advertising, creativity, platforms, and the intersection of it all. Join us each session for timely and relevant discussions on all things China marketing. We'll be joined by an entire spectrum of China experts. And you can learn more about Shanghai Zan at our website, zanstation.com. I'm Bryce Witwam.
And I'm Ali Kazmi.
And Ali, we would like to thank everyone for their continued support. As we always say at the beginning of our podcast, if you like the show, share it with your friends, tell your family, give us that five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Today, Ali, I have to say that we always talk about our impressive numbers of our podcast, and we say, well, we've got 250,000 downloads, but today we are talking to a podcast legend.
Legend already. Oh my God.
A legend already. Yes, yes, absolutely. I'll tell you a funny story, Bessie, as well. Today, we're honored to have Bessie Lee, who is the lead host of the podcast Bei Wang Lu, a podcast focused on China leadership and innovation. And as of today, Ali, Bei Wang Lu has amassed 301,513 followers on Xiaoyuzhou, which is far higher than our number, Ali, by like 1,000%.
Well, thank you. But you have massive download outside of China. That is envy of me.
Yeah, well, I think we always say it's the language. We talked a lot about doing a Chinese podcast, didn't we, Ali? But we just never got around to doing it.
That's right. Yeah, I think we would be quite famous, and I think we should give it a try, actually. We just need to do one podcast and see what happens.
Okay. Also, joining us today is Peter Bulmer, who wrote the book China Inside Out, which is based on the Bei Wang Lu's podcast. Peter and Bessie were colleagues previously in Shanghai for quite a few years. But why I said a legend, and I have to tell you a funny story. I was at an academic conference, and they pair you up into different groups, and I was in the advertising group, and I presented my speech, and then there was a lady, I think she was from Penn State University, from China, and she talked about podcasts and podcast marketing and how podcasts can be a valuable tool, you know, in your marketing spectrum. And she actually mentioned Bei Wang Lu as the podcast as one of her examples in her lecture.
Oh my.
And yeah, and afterwards I said, hey, by the way, I happen to know Bessie. And she was really surprised. And she was like, of course I was name dropping. And I said, oh gosh, you know, I adore her. I love the podcast. I think it's awesome. And then she's kind of looking at me like with a little bit of suspicion. She said, how do you know Bessie, by the way? And I said, I looked at her and said, 她以前是我的老板. You know, I said, she used to be my boss. So,
oh my God.
It was great.
Wow,
yeah, she couldn't believe it.
Oh my God.
So more about the book, China Inside Out explores themes as the digital transformation in China retail, the distinctive characteristics of Chinese entrepreneurs, innovation strategies, and the challenges and opportunities within China's unique business environment, with guests like Wang Zimin, who's the founder of Nova Vision, Liu Xiaolu, co-founder of Neiwai, the lingerie brand, Hong Yongpu, founder of Yongpu Coffee. It delves into the insights from these and other Chinese innovators, offering a look at the forces behind modern Chinese commerce, including the cultural and technological shifts that influence business practices. You emphasize the importance of Chinese business culture and highlight the innovative approaches Chinese entrepreneurs are taking to navigate and shape the rapidly evolving market landscape. Bessie, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Bessie, tell us a little bit about the name Bei Wang Lu. What does it mean in English? How did you come up with the name, and how does it reflect the content and perhaps the inspiration of the content that you share with your listeners?
Okay. Well, actually, Bei Wang Lu phonetically sounds pronounced exactly like a memo in Chinese. Okay. So I think when people mention the name of my podcast, the loyal listeners would know that it's a very informative podcast. It's about business model, innovation, marketing, you know, so on and so forth. And there is a lot of really good, solid information that they were actually will write down and use it at their works, whether it's the students doing their reports or agency people using it in their pitch or in their clients planning, marketeers using those informations as a reference on marketing, you know, new marketing approach, or even investors actually listen to my show, trying to understand certain business model. So it really reflects how they, you know, sort of the learning they will gather from the show. So that's the aspiration. But the Chinese character of Bei Wang Lu, even though sound-wise it's pronounced exactly like memo, but the character itself is different. Bei is seashell Bei, Bei Ke de Bei, okay? Wang is gaze or hope, and Lu is recording. Now, why Bei? Because my English name is Bessie. So in China, people who know me for a long time will call me Bei Xi or Bei Zong. So that Bei is seashell Bei. So this actually was put together by a friend of mine who's a designer, actually, in marketing, in an agency. He put together Bei because he said, well, you're a Bei Zong, right? So he used Bei. And then he said, well, if this is the aspiration of your podcast, I think Bei Wang Lu, the name, the pronunciation is exactly the same, but with a different character. That could be an interesting play with character. So that's how we arrive at Bei Wang Lu.
Got it. And how many episodes have you done so far?
Oh my, I've done more than 100. I have to check.
Okay.
I've done so many now. I have done 136.
Wow. Okay. It's incredible. And to our listeners, Bei Wang Lu is in Chinese. It's you've done some English episodes, I know.
I've done one episode with Brompton Bike CEO. That's an experiment, but we were pleasantly surprised by how well it was received by the listeners.
Okay, that's awesome. Mm. And just for our audience, you can subscribe to Bei Wang Lu on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It's all there as well as Xiao Yu Zhou. To Peter, I wonder what was the can you tell us about the motivation behind writing a book about this, and what is the genesis and the innovation? Why are the stories relevant, and what got you inspired to write this book?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I was in China for 20 years. Bessie and I have been friends for most of that period. I was her client when I looked after, I was Johnny Walker brand director for Asia, which is when we met. And I got fascinated with China very early on. And I've been trying to write a book on the place for quite a few years, actually. And as you'll know yourself, Bryce, the more you read and research and spend time and understand things about China, the bigger and more sprawling the subject gets. So I was struggling a little bit. What had started as a fairly clear book on why Chinese and Western culture so often find themselves at an impasse was just sprawling out of control. So one fine day, Bessie had an idea that maybe there was a book in the podcast. So she'd got some of her episodes translated and she pinged it to me and said, could you have a look? Is there a book here? And the answer was that no, there wasn't a book there because what you had was a bunch of.
It was a disaster when we first put it together.
kind of, you know, very informal, if informative chats, the strength, the informality, I think, when as pure podcasts, but it didn't work as a book. So I just realized we had an opportunity to bring the two things together. I could use the episodes to illustrate a lot of the points that I wanted to make about how Chinese entrepreneurs think, how that's different from the way Western people and Western business people think in particular. And it just came together like that. We've got another one in the pipeline, actually. So with a bit of luck, this will lead to regular publications.
As soon as I got it, I was kind of looking at it going like, it's just a transcript of the podcast. But then when I actually read it, which, by the way, didn't take me very long because it's quite short, I was just thinking to myself, like, why is it so short? Why could this easily have made this a lot more, you could really added a lot more stories. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really great. And it always reminded me of the reasons glad a lot of that. Us went to China and worked there for so long, and just meeting the people and hearing the stories, and it just reminded me of all those great moments and meeting people like this and just being so enamored by them and so fascinated by them. So yes, write more.
Well, thank you,
it's
Bryce.
Too short.
Yeah. In the pipeline. Yeah, that was the big issue, getting the translations done, actually. Complete nightmare. And of course, that's much more straightforward now.
Are you using ChatGPT for any of your translation or editing work as well? Or
not for the editing. I did that. But ChatGPT now for the translation of the transcripts. And then they need a bit of a sense check, obviously. But I mean, that will cut down the process by, weeks, if not months.
Yeah, this first book, the transcript was done, by human translator, right? We got to get it down to transcript first, from audio to transcript in Chinese, then have it translated in Chinglish, really. I wouldn't even say it's English, Chinglish. But that whole process was the nightmare because it just took so long. And at the first book, it took us, 2 years, Peter, I think?
Yeah, something like that. And it, in between other projects, and it took a bit of unpicking too, because sometimes the translations were pretty hard to fathom. So there was a lot of back and forth trying to make sure we captured what was actually said and just maybe rewriting slightly without changing the meaning,
So, I love what you said about writing books about China. I think it was Kaiser Guo that once said, your first year in China, you can write a book. And every year after that, you become so engaged and so, accustomed to the culture and everything, that things that you first saw that you said, oh, that's great for a book, suddenly just become commonplace and you don't notice it anymore. And then after a few years, it goes from a book to an article to a PowerPoint deck.
Yeah,
after 20 years.
It's true. And I think also you realize after time, that some of the interpretations you had early on in your first sort of 2-3 years were just wrong. And it's around about year 7 or 8 that you actually start to feel you've got a handle on things. That was my experience, and certainly a lot of other, long-term China hands that I know say similar things. Crazy place. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, but crazy.
I guess the next question is, with 130-plus podcasts, why did you choose these stories? I mean, you must have, when you wrote it, you must have really had to struggle with that, to say, which ones do we add, which ones do we keep? What is the nexus behind the stories that you selected for this first book?
Maybe I'll go first and then Peter can jump in. We actually first, I selected 10 episodes from the first 2 years of content or podcasts that I produce. The reason why I thought a book would be interesting was that some of the podcast content, it's so micro, meaning it is an emerging brand. It is an innovation by an enterprise CEOs. That none of the media outside of China will cover. But these are brilliant innovations that I think a lot of the international brands might find interesting, especially those who are competing with these emerging brands in China. So I picked 10 episodes that cover brands that are Chinese brands, or cover approach of marketing, approach of business, or business model that started here, started in China. So that's how I picked those 10. And then we did the translation, the transcript and all that. And then I sit down with Peter and said, out of these 10, I think original plan was to publish all 10, but then we started cutting out ones that were not so sure, and then came down to this 5 that you saw in the book.
Yeah, to pick up there, if I can, the idea was to create balance in the book. And actually, this is really why the book is as short as it is, Bryce. The 5 that we picked, you've got both a range of very different characters and different types of business, and you've got a polarity with quite a sort of international classic strategic approach at one extreme and a very Chinese, more ad hoc approach at the other extreme. And they all, to a greater or lesser extent, sort of hone in on things that explain what makes China so different and Chinese entrepreneurs in particular. All of this with a view, you know, as someone who had several businesses that did quite well in China after the Diageo days, it was not easy to do that. It was not at all easy to do that. And so all of them, I think, also are illuminating for someone from the West who might want to try and do something in China and make a success of it. So that's the reason, you know, we didn't decide specifically five. We just found five that we thought worked in a really balanced way. Now, whether or not, you know, next time round we can do more than that, I don't know. It remains to be seen. Only written one book so far, so by no means an expert. But you know, that's why it is as it is anyway, and that's how we pick them.
Do you think maybe because of some of the shared themes that were emerging from the different entrepreneurs and founders that you talked to, it would have perhaps made sense to collaborate?
Yeah, that's part of it. But there's contrast there too. So you know, we talk about this thing, scruffy innovation, which is this very Chinese, incredibly fleet of foot, adaptable, flexible, fast-moving, experimental way of doing things. But you've also got the contrast to that in Neiwai, which is really quite a measured classical strategic approach. So there are commonalities and there are contrasts, and that was a deliberate piece of planning. We wanted to show that. I do think there is a common theme that comes through very strongly, and it's something to do with Chinese entrepreneurs receiving the whole digital package in one go as a kind of fully formed thing and being able to play with it in a way that people in the West never had the opportunity to do and find new and exciting ways to use it. You know, we included that lovely, it's quite old, but that lovely New York Times video on WeChat as one of the links. Now, we have nothing like that in the West. We have people now who are trying to recreate that because they've seen what it can be like, but we have as yet nothing like it. And yet, that was not planned. That was completely accidental. It's what happens when you bring all of these elements into a discrete kind of intranet, if you like, the Chinese intranet. And then people play and experiment and develop and say, well, hang on a minute, why don't we put a bit of this in there and a bit of that in here? And it grows in this organic and experimental way. And that, in my experience, is an incredibly Chinese way of approaching life and business in particular. And I do think that is a common theme through the book, with possibly one exception, Neiwai, which takes rather a different approach.
If I can summarize what you're saying, there's an ensemble of possibility, Chinese possibility, digital possibility that's been offered to entrepreneurs in China. And as a result, there's a lot more experimentation or the possibility of experimentation. And therefore, you know, this ad hoc strategy. But, you know, creating that intranet, you know, without knowing or without having a crystal ball to gaze into and say, this is the future and this is what we need to be doing. That seems to be very different from the West. What is it about the way that Chinese entrepreneurs, you know, how do they tackle experimentation, trial and error, and innovation that's different to the way the West does?
First of all, I think the last 40-some years of this modern Chinese history is all about trial and error. I think there is a famous saying, right, Deng Xiaoping, you cross the river by feeling the stones, because you don't know, you know, where your next step is. You want to make sure that you're stepping on a solid stone in order to cross the river. So that itself is a trial and error. So the whole success of the last 40-some years is trial and error. And to a lot of the entrepreneurs, there really is no legacy because everything is new. So when they go out and try a new approach or try a new model, and they saw that new model, new approach, got really good positive response from the users, whether the users are to see real consumer users, you got a business enterprise user that responded really well. So that just sort of reinforced their confidence of continue trying. Even if they will fail, many, many failures what we've seen in the last 22 years I've been here. But what you're seeing these entrepreneurs do when they do come across failure is they just quickly learn from it. They don't dwell upon oh my God, I fell, you know, end of my life, end of the world for me. No, no, no. They just sort of learn from it and quickly move on because they know that they can't really stand still. Because if you stand still and you feel sorry for yourself, I'm sorry, competition will just, you know, just catch up and fill the gap or grab the opportunities in front of you. So I think that trial and error spirit was deeply rooted in how this whole nation is operated and then how people approach problems and challenges.
Yeah, and to build on that, I really agree. That's such a strong cultural force in China, and it has everything to do with the nature of the place. Continuity that for large parts of its history have been quite cut off from everywhere else. A life that in the past has been deeply unpredictable for ordinary people and often quite, you know, dangerously so. There's a really deeply ingrained resilience, flexibility, adaptability, and even fatalism. So, you know, Bessie's point just now about not worrying too much about failure, it's not just that they don't dwell on it, it's that they're not frightened of it. You know, at many points in the past, there's been very little to lose. And so people will throw themselves into things, but they've developed over millennia this unbelievable fleetness of foot that allows them to adapt and change when things don't go quite wrong. And that's a uniquely Chinese skill, I believe, something that the West could learn a huge amount from. Quite how you acquire it, I don't know, but it's a very Chinese phenomenon. And there are other things at play there too. You know, the novelty, everything is new. There are no rules. You know, a product in China can be whatever you decide it's going to be. And people are still excited by what's new and still willing to try things. And that applies to the consumer side and the business side. So you have those forces all coming together. You have a rather fully formed digital environment that sort of lands in one go. And you have the size of the place. So there are businesses that rely on digital networks, the internet, social media, that couldn't work in the West because the scale isn't there to support them. But they can work just fine in China. So it's got these lovely, unique factors that have all come together. Nobody planned it. I don't believe anybody planned it, but I think it's just an incredibly happy accident. And it's led to a very fertile business culture.
In the book, Wu Xiaobo, he mentions that. He says that China is the best place to do a startup. And a word that came out, which I love, is curiosity. That Chinese are just so, they're naturally curious and not about to be ashamed about something that's not working. I think having lived in Thailand for 5 years, which was an amazing experience. I love the country so much. The difference, I think, between Thais and Chinese is that Chinese are just not happy with anything in their life. They're always looking to try to improve it, and they're always complaining about everything. Whereas the Thais were pretty much like, this is just, we just have such a great life. Why change anything? And I think that
that's true, I think.
That sense of not seeing perfection, but also curiosity, like creates this ultimate model of startups and entrepreneurship. But I have a question though, and it may be because Ali and I just did this trends show not too long ago with Chris Baker about the lack of optimism now, and that a lot we hear about the Tangping, the lying flat, unmotivated youth, lack of optimism, unemployment. That kind of seems almost contradictory to what we've been talking about. Do you think China's still the best place for a startup, given the current situation?
I think the generations that were born after the late 80s, they grew up seeing the economy boom, right? So it's all about prosperity. Everything that happened in China is all about success. It's all about growing the business. They have never actually been in any period where it's a dip. So I think a lot of the young generation have no idea how to cope with this. They don't know. Not like, I mean, us, right? Well, Ali is much younger. But for me, at least for me, I've been through several cycles already. You've got the Asian financial crisis. You've got the global financial crisis. You've got a lot of stuff or dips that you've seen before. Like 2001, 9/11. So you've seen dips before, and you you know, you back then I was a junior, but I worked with bosses who let you out of that dip. But this generation, their bosses also grew up in, you know, enjoying this prosperity. So they had no idea how to grow out of or how to lead the team out of the dip. And their parents, even though their parents probably had been through a lot as well, but it's a very different dip, if you like. So my observation by looking at just the team that I'm working with every day in my current company, I think a lot of them just don't know how to cope with it. And when, you know, it's very common when you don't know how to cope with something, you just sort of withdraw yourself from it, hoping that it will just go away quickly. So that's my observations of why this tumping, this lie flat phenomenon that we're seeing.
I think also too, and this bears out in some of the research, is that sometimes dips are good. Dips mean that people won't change jobs every 6 months like they used to. We talk about the grand old days of China, but I also remember seeing people suddenly go from account executive to account director in 2 years, and they changed three jobs. There was such an ease of employment opportunities. But now it's not the case. And that is golden opportunity for entrepreneurs and people wanting to do different things because they frankly have a staff that will stay with them for a while and won't change. And also cost of goods and cost of things will be lower because people are slightly more desperate than they used to be. Mm-hmm. So in some aspects, resets, I think it's in some aspects a good thing for China. A reset could be also a way to spark opportunities by having everything a little bit more accessible than it used to.
Yeah. I also have the feeling that, you know, if we look at, let's say, the growth of Alibaba and Tencent, and I mean, even Baidu to some extent, I think you're probably alluding to this sense of competitiveness as well. If they don't do it, then someone else will. And if someone else does, then, you know, they're, you know, whatever they started off doing, whether it's e-commerce or search or even electronic vehicles, that they would be, you know, that they would be disrupted. I kind of feel like over the last 20 years, it's just, you know, you have to be constantly innovating and you have to always have this pioneer mindset. And if you lose that even for 1 second, then you're just going to be replaced by someone else.
I think that's right. And I think there's an advantage that young Chinese entrepreneurial types have in that respect, in that they're not necessarily trying to be the next Alibaba or Tencent. That, you know, there is a lot of scope for small-scale entrepreneurialism. And in fact, quite a lot of those big giants in China started that way and probably never had an idea where it was all going to lead them. And actually, that kind of entrepreneurialism on a relatively small, unchallenging scale that doesn't require big investment and big risk, perfect timing for that. Out of that, future behemoths will grow, I believe.
Do you think that China, like, do you think that there is a system, this is something that an old boss actually said to me. He's like, you know, there is the way and there is a way. Mm-hmm. And the system is set up so that you follow the way. And so to your point, right, there is a lot of rigor, academic rigor, and there's a lot of expectation, societal pressures, et cetera. And there's a, you know, there's a set of things that you have to go through, whether it's education, passing your Gaokao, getting an advanced degree, getting married, buying the apartment, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's a way, and that's where that, you know, that innovation or that restlessness, because of all of that constraint, there's this other side to, you know, Chinese entrepreneurs, which is all about, you know, this, how can I do everything that I was, how can I explore what I was not able to as I went through the system and the process that was, you know, that was advised to me.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite true. And I think that sort of, it's a sort of restlessness as much as a competitive instinct to keep fiddling, keep tweaking, keep experimenting. And I actually think that could be the greatest Chinese export to the rest of the world, if only they could find a way to package it. Because, I mean, I actually got stuck in the UK by lockdown. I was here on a visit, which is why I'm not in Shanghai at the moment. But it's been interesting to me to draw the comparison between the way people are here and the way people are there. And, you know, I think a lot of youngsters here are actually conditioned not to believe that there is anything they can do beyond the sort of standard paths, which is enormously unhealthy. So, you know, you've got to get your exams, you've got to get a good degree, then you go to a good company, all that sort of thing. And a lot of people don't even bother trying because they don't believe that's for them. And those that could do something more exciting and inspiring have had that conditioned out of them, actually. So that's a sort of typically first world problem. And perhaps it's a facet of the fact that things have been, on average, quite comfortable in the West for quite a long time. But there are ways of doing things in China that are totally different to that, which would be an incredibly healthy injection of vitality for the West, if only we could find a way to tap into them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you look at different generations of entrepreneurial in China, ever since startup was encouraged, the first generation was the Huawei generation, right? Ren Zhengfei started Huawei. When they started those brands back then, it's patriotism, right? It's, I carry the nation's future on my shoulder. We are China. We should have our own mobile brands. We should have this brand and that brand as well. So that's that first generation of entrepreneurial. Then you have Jack Ma and Pony Ma. You can argue that how they started a business in your Alibaba, it's a replica of a model that's already proven successful in the West, right? So they saw that as a, you know, like, we should have that sort of product as well in China. So they borrow or copy that model, but quickly evolve it into something that even the original platform out of the West didn't recognize. So that's that second generation. But the third generation entrepreneurial were the founders behind Temu, Pinduoduo, behind TikTok, behind Shein. These are the generation that have been exposed to the world. I mean, they either study overseas or they have, because of, you know, their parents, you know, doing financially quite well, so they're able to travel to many places in the world. And they themselves have used the Western, you know, platforms or products. But they started reflecting that, well, there has to be a better platform, or there has to be a platform that can satisfy better Chinese consumers' needs. So they came out with a very different business model. Pinduoduo, when they first came out, everybody laughed at them because Alibaba didn't really pay any attention. Alibaba thought Pinduoduo was a platform for senior citizens, for, you know, the lower tier city consumers. We shouldn't be bothered. They paid no attention to them. But this is like your innovator's dilemma, right? In the end, Alibaba got taken over. And Shein is also another, you know, brand new sort of Zara, but completely made for the digital generation. Now, these are, I will argue, the first entrepreneurial generation that has really original innovation in their business model, in their product design. Electric vehicle is the same. Now, electric vehicle, the entry barrier for innovation is a lot easier because the old automobile industry, it's a very closed industry and it's a very well established. Nobody wants to disrupt it, and it requires tech in engine. It's a very advanced technology. But electric vehicle doesn't have that kind of barrier. It's a perfect ground for young entrepreneur in China to really innovate the next generation of automobile. So I think there is that differences between the three generations of entrepreneurial and innovators.
Yeah, I think I want to touch on this point that you're making on the you know, localizing and adapting, so whether it's platforms or it's cars. And in this case also, you know, when you look at coffee, or I think there was a recent article on how, you know, some of these big American brands like Tesla and Apple are not innovating fast enough for the Chinese market. And so when you look at some of these more established brands, do you think that, you know, they've been better at adapting their product for the local market, whether it's Biadi or Xiaomi or Luckin. And obviously, you know, we mentioned Luckin over here only because they struggled 3 years ago. They've turned around. They're making a profit now. And they've got more stores than Starbucks in China. What do you think the story, or what do you think is behind their success, and how have they kind of adapted, or how are Chinese companies adapting to consumer needs?
If I can comment on Luckin, and which is also quite similar to Yongpu Cafe, Yongpu Coffee, that's included in our book. Now, if you look at Luckin, they actually penetrated much deeper than Starbucks into the lower tier cities. Now, in those lower tier cities, you have new coffee drinkers who have never drank coffee before. Luckin's coffee, the regular coffee is 9.9 renminbi, which is about one third of Starbucks' regular coffee cost. So what does that mean? That means for a new coffee drinker in lower tier cities, 10 renminbi is a much lower opportunity cost or trial cost for me to enter coffee. So if I have to spend three times more the cost in order to experiment or in order to try coffee, I'm going to think about it. Do I want to spend that kind of money? So I think that entry barrier is a lot lower for lower tier city coffee drinkers. Yongpu, similar. Yongpu, in my episode with the founder, he said, well, look, we live in Shanghai, and there's so many coffee shops near you, and make good coffee as well. So you have a great coffee shop around the corner from where you live. But he said in the lower tier city, is that the case? But you have people, young people, who wanted to drink good quality coffee. So what do? You make good quality instant coffee, what do you call it, the freeze coffee powder, right? Or the capsule. They can just buy online and they can make good quality coffee in their home. That's how coffee was introduced to this younger generation. So it's a very different way of opening up the market to coffee, or to young generation who's never drank coffee before, but they're curious, they wanted to try. So it's a very different way of you have an addressable market, but you have an insight of, you know, these consumers' sort of trial behavior. How do they see the opportunity cost? How do I put together a product or a retail approach or pricing approach to attract them and eventually convert them into a coffee drinker?
What do you think, Peter? Yeah, because you've done a lot of you're very close to the beverages industry.
Not coffee per se, except as a personal heavy user. But that innovation is in the eye of the recipient, isn't it? So if you're a youngster in a fourth tier city and suddenly someone brings you a coffee capsule shaped like a flying saucer, that's highly innovative. And I do think that's part of the answer to your question. It's not necessarily all about innovation per se, or rather it's about innovation of where and how as much as it is about what. I think that's a big difference. I think also, you know, a lot of things come back to this restless experimentation. If you're Apple, you put months, if not years, of research into a major breakthrough, and you aim to make it absolutely perfect before you take it to market. And that's a really deeply entrenched way of thinking about business and way of doing things. In China, people are much more happy to fling something out there half formed and see how it works. And consumers are very receptive to that. They're not conditioned to having had, you know, years and years and years of customer service expectations or what have you. So, and they're all kind of equally excited by this bubbling upswell of new stuff. So I think there is something in that about innovation. And I think it's a bit more devil may care in China. And I think that's quite a healthy thing.
This pivot this towards foreign brands that still want to think about growing opportunities. I know that, I know Ali and I are hopeless optimists, and we always tell companies and brands that there are still opportunities. I think in the book, there's one of my favorite chapters is on MYK, the story of how building that. And I think that's just an excellent story that all companies, foreign companies need to read about how to create niche opportunities. That's with Chen Yaping. I believe Bessie, your former colleague at Mindshare.
Yes.
Yeah. So how can non-Chinese innovators succeed in the Chinese market today? What are the steps that they need to take? Obviously, they're not as established. They don't have the investment capital that the local brands have. What does it take to actually win in China in 2024?
Well, the first and most important thing is you need somebody who actually knows. I spent a lot of time in the last 15 years talking to brands who were desperate to get into China. And all of them were convinced that there's a straightforward route, and that's to get onto Tmall or Taobao or whatever. And most of them broke even at best. And when things didn't work for them, they'd go to the platform and the platform would say, well, you need to spend more on marketing. And they would, and it would uplift the sales, but it would also uplift the costs. That there's a lot of sort of strongly held belief that there are ways of cracking China that are somehow rather magical. It used to be the billions argument. You know, imagine if you could take just 1% of the market, how hard is that going to be? Then it became the sort of e-commerce platform argument. I don't think I can think of a single example of that working. So the first thing you need to do is to have someone available to you who really knows where those niches are and how you best target them. And that's a very difficult thing to accomplish if you haven't been in China for a long time. But those niches are still there. They still exist. And there are still smart ways to target them. If you've been around in China for a while, as I had been before I started my first business there, you're better off and worse off. I mean, my huge challenge was I'd worked at Diageo with a Chinese team who'd all been educated at INSEAD and places like that. And it had convinced me that I had a really good grasp of how you work with a Chinese team. But of course, they had a very different perspective to most Chinese youngsters. So when I put my radio broadcasting business together, I had a team of about 50, 30 of which were Chinese, from top universities, very bright kids, really willing, really engaged. But I had to unlearn everything I thought about, I knew about how you make a team in China really gel and really work together. It's a completely different animal. And actually, to a large extent, I think what you learn is you have to step back and let them get on with it. And not try to get them to follow a different philosophy of business. So those would be sort of personal things for me. The short answer is it's very difficult and not many people have succeeded in doing it.
Yeah. And if you can just chunk China down into a biteable size, don't really try to take up the entire China. I mean, the longer I live in China, the less I know about China, because every day you're learning something new again. So chunk it down. And even a small segment of the market is already probably big enough for your business. But the thing is, you just need to spot that that gap in the market. But there is a need. There's a real need, but there's not enough solution there to satisfy those needs. So chunk it down and get focused.
And you can chunk it in multiple ways, can't you? So, you know, you can chunk it by route to market, by platform, just as much as you can chunk it city by city. It's good. There's a lot of flexibility for doing that in China, which is valuable.
My wife had a great experience doing that with her furniture business. You know, she set up Kava Kava. She had one store, and then she raised to four stores, and it was just humming along. Selling Chinese furniture to foreigners. That was her niche. It did really well. And then suddenly, as expected with everything in China, suddenly there was like four competitors that suddenly came and copied her exact business model. Like everything was exactly the same. So, and then we had to like pivot, and that was the challenge. So I always think that what I always tell people is that even if you find the right niche of the chunk or the group that you're looking at, always think by 3 years down the road that you're going to lose that, and you need to like pivot into something else because it's constantly changing. The opportunity's there, and then it's suddenly gone.
Here's a question. I'm just, as an observer, to what you've said on your wife's business, but also this conversation that we're having on Alibaba, and also something that one of our former guests on the show has said about advertising in China as well. Do you think it's going from niche to getting scale and being the biggest possible player in that industry and just monopolizing it in order for you to continue to exist? Because if you don't do that, then you will be disrupted and you will be replaced. And so I wonder if that's also a driving force for constant innovation, knowing that, you know, if you don't keep on expanding or if you don't keep on growing your pipeline, if you don't keep on introducing or innovating your product, finding new ways to connect with consumers, you're just, you know, like, you know, is China a market for small companies and small brands at all?
Funnily enough, as a foreign brand owner, as long as you've got the right kind of brand, I think it is. So, you know, the kind of brand that people may feel more inclined to trust, perhaps, because it isn't subject to some of those forces that you're talking about, you know, people trying to rapidly bring something else to market and copy and compete and what have you. And something that you can show very clearly what the sort of shipping history was, which is relatively easy to do if you get the shop front right, then actually small is beautiful, just as it is almost anywhere in the world. For anything that aspires to be a large company, you've got to be in it for the very long term. You've got to expect to take some very nasty knocks. Is it all about constant innovation? I'm not sure I can think of a Western business that's succeeded in China in that way. I think it's more that you master a way of doing things that no one else is that inclined to do. Yeah, I think that can lead to success.
I think we have had, I would say, maybe 15 years of everything is about scale. But in recent years, especially after the pandemic, I'm hearing different voices or different reflection. I'm hearing people asking themselves or asking their business community, is it really necessary scale is the best? Because scale, in order to go after that scale, you have to pay a lot of price. And once you get that scale, that means you are high profile. You become everybody's target. So everyone is trying to come in and trying to, you know, cut piece from your business. And everyone is trying to be there to beat you, to replace you. So is scale necessarily the best thing? If going IPO, because going IPO normally is the financial investor's incentive, it's not necessarily the founder's incentive. So if you're not necessarily trying to go after public listing, do you really need scale? Scale don't necessarily deliver profit in China. So I'm hearing different voices from entrepreneurial asking themselves, maybe I should just don't worry about scale for now. I need to build a business with a sustainable model that I can make profit, and that profit is able to sustain me to the next phase. Because admit it, I mean, at the moment, it's very difficult to raise funding. It's no longer like in the, I don't know, 2010, 2012. There's so many money in the market, hot money in the market going after, you know, startup, going after entrepreneurial, right? It's no longer that case. So if there's no more that much hot money in the market for me to raise, then I need to be careful with my business. I need to continue to make profit so I can sustain my business till the next phase until I get discovered by investors who thought that my business has a sustainable model and I'm willing to invest in my business. So it is a good reflection. Finally, we have a different voice in the market. Not necessarily everybody is after scale, but it's about quality now. It's about profitability. That's the fundamental of business, right?
I mean, that leads to quite an interesting point, because the first 10 years or so I was in China, there were no what I would call true brands. There was nobody who developed a really sticky personality and set of values for their product that really strongly appealed to a Chinese market or a segment of that market. I always thought, and in fact, people used to say to me that branding just doesn't work here. And I would say, well, how do you know if no one's ever tried it? And they would say, typically, well, if it worked, someone would have tried it. So it was all a bit circular. But actually, you know, you mentioned MYK Plus, Bryce, and Neiwai too. I think those are two interesting companies in that they both had a very clear, rather values-based position that was strongly appealing and convincing also. And they've nurtured that and protected that. And that is actually a relatively new phenomenon in China, in my opinion. And so there may be opportunities to achieve real scale through some of those more standard approaches that are commonly used overseas, but just haven't really been part of the picture while China went for explosive growth over 20 years or so.
I know this podcast could go on for hours with you guys. I knew this was going to happen. There's so many interesting stories. We'd love to have you on again, but it is time now. Ali, are we ready for the A-B test?
We're absolutely ready for the A-B test. So two words, choose one, and you reply back. We start with Bessie. Memos or reports?
Memo.
Seashells or new shores?
New shores.
Bessie, 136 or 1,360?
136.
China innovation or Western innovation?
China innovation.
Classic strategy or ad hoc strategy?
Ad hoc strategy.
Yongpu coffee or Luckin coffee?
Yongpu coffee, easy.
Restless experimentation or rule-based experimentation?
Restless experimentation.
Startup or corporation?
Oh, startup, every time.
Stairway or elevator?
Stairway.
Last one, sustainability or scale?
Sustainability.
Bessie, Peter, thanks for being on the show. The book is entitled China Inside Out, China's Innovators in Their Own Words. It's available on Amazon. We'll put a link in the show notes for the book. I suggest anyone who has lived in China for a while, or you've not been to China and haven't lived there, to read this book. It's just, you finish it, you want more. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Bryce, Ali, for having me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us on today's episode. Join us in a few weeks for another exciting show. And to all our listeners, until then, have a great day.